On the line now, we should have Brian Brunton. Brian, are you there?
Yeah, I can. You're a bit faint, but I can hear you.
Okay.
Fine.
So, Brian, perhaps you'd like to tell us a little bit about yourself. I mean, I introduced you before as a long-time campaigner in Papua New Guinea on issues around environmental and social justice, but perhaps you'd like to tell the listeners just a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Well, I'm a citizen of Papua New Guinea, although I was born in the United Kingdom and currently in the United Kingdom, but I'm a citizen of Papua New Guinea. I'm an environmental lawyer. I've worked with non-government organizations, conservation and community groups on environmental issues for the past 10 years.
Right, so just tell us a little bit more about Papua New Guinea. I mentioned earlier that it's sort of a country in this part of the world, at least in North America, a lot of people don't know very much about it at all, except if we're lucky where it is on the map.
Right. It really is at the periphery of the periphery. It's half of that big north island to the north of Australia. It's a tropical country, 5 million people, very, 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 very diverse people, 750-odd languages, distinct languages, really separate languages, and a whole lot more dialects. Very small communities. The land is still owned communally under custom, and the government looks after that. Only 3% of the land is in actual what I would call corporate or private or government hands. 97% of the land is still owned by people living under customary tenure.
So how does that work when you talk about customary tenure? What's the difference there to, say, with the sort of the standard Western kind of ideas of private property ownership and so on?
There's not a lot of difference. That farmers in, customary owners in Papua New Guinea are probably the same, have got the same sort of mentality as farmers in Texas. In other words, they're very territorial. And the way it works is this, is it squeezes the state and the corporations out, that the customary owners do really have control, and the state and the corporations have to tippy-toe around them and be very careful what they do.
Right. Now, you've mentioned the corporations and the state, and I guess Papua New Guinea became independent in 1975. What's been the history of both the state and transnational corporations in the last, 35 years or 25 years of Papua New Guinean independence?
Yeah, it's a gradual process of corporation and state attempting to get control at the expense of community and not doing very well. Community is still strong, the customary groups are still strong, and the state and the big corporations struggle.
Right, but the history, I guess, in terms of going back before even the independence, there has been certainly interest in Papua New Guinea, because to the eyes of large corporations, PNG is seen as being a sort of a resource rich place. Can you talk a little bit about the kinds of operations that are there?
Yeah, well, I mean, originally, Papua New Guinea was colonized very late, the 1880s, and nobody really wanted it because they couldn't see how to exploit it. There was nothing there worth stealing. Eventually, the Germans made a grab because the Germans were short on colonies. And it was essentially a real estate grab for the northern half of New Guinea. And it was a real estate grab that failed. The intention was to set up the German Development Corporation and then sell off bits of land to other Germans and make a profit. In essence, malaria and dysentery beat that one, and a lot of Germans died, and the German government had to take over in about 1900. The British, as a result of the Germans occupying the northern half, were forced by the missionaries and by Australian chauvinism to grab Papua, which is the southern side of things. Again, there was a bit of gold. That was an attraction in the early days. But in essence, there was nothing there worth stealing. And then the Second World War came along. And, of course, what the Japanese did in the Second World War is it was a monumental decolonization exercise, and the Dutch got kicked out of Indonesia eventually, and the British lost control of much of Asia. And the Australians hung on to their part of New Guinea. But by that time, the Decolonization Committee started to come alive, and the Decolonization Committee forced the Australians to do something about what is now Papua New Guinea. The Australians started to scratch themselves because they couldn't see how it was going to be so-called viable. And they started to pull in investors. They pulled in two types. First off, there were the Japanese logging companies and the British oil palm companies, the Commonwealth Development Corporation and Harrison and Crossfield. And eventually they enticed Rio Tinto Zinc into Bougainville. And there's a big gold and copper mine in Bougainville. Now, of course, that was an absolute disaster, both socially and environmentally, and we ended up with a 10-year civil war in which something between 12 to 16,000 people died, largely through disease and starvation because of a blockade that the Papua New Guinea government cast around the Bougainville Island. The Australians also enticed first Kennecott into Papua New Guinea, but Kennecott got caught up in the Chilean Allende coup, and so Kennecott was kicked out, and BHP, that's Broken Hill Proprietary, now BHP Billiton, was brought in, and BHP was brought in because the Papua New Guinea government, the young Papua New Guinea government, guessed that it was a weak multinational and that they could handle it better than they could handle Kennecott. So that by the time of independence, the Australians had dragged in the oil palm companies. They'd also dragged in the Japanese logging companies, and they start to drag in two mining companies, that's RTZ and BHP.
So the Australian governments continue to play a key role in Papua New Guinea, as I understand it, but also other international international institutions like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund have maintained quite a strong role in trying to get the Papua New Guinean government and the Papua New Guinean economy and society to be restructured along the lines that it wants. Can you talk a little bit about those relationships and those issues and impacts?
Yeah, I mean, I think first the Australians. The Australians have always had this view of forward defence, which they pinched off the British, because the British believed that they should fight their battles in Belgium. The Australians copied that strategic way of defence and believed that they should fight their battles in the arc of instability, which is to the north of Australia. And so the Second World War for Australia was largely fought in Papua New Guinea. But apart from that, there has been considerable Australian investment. Now, when I say considerable, I mean Australia is only a small to middling capital exporting country. It's largely a capital importing country, bringing in money firstly from the United Kingdom and now more so from the United States or from Asia. So the Australians are not particularly strong when it comes to capital. However, in Australian terms, they do have significant investments in Papua New Guinea, and they have a defence national interest in this arc to the north of Australia, which runs, I would say, from eastern Indonesia through the New Guinea island, down through the Solomon Islands to Vanuatu. That's their area of both defense and commercial interest, and they've shown themselves to be quite robust over that. I mean, they kicked the Indonesians out of East Timor by the use of military force a couple of years ago. They've intervened militarily directly in the Solomon Islands, and now there's a sort of a low-budget intervention going on in Papua New Guinea. Because Australia is a relatively weak capital exporting country, it's had to use the World Bank to prop up its interests in Papua New Guinea, and the World Bank and the IMF have shown some interest in Papua New Guinea in attempting to bring what it considers to be rationality into the Papua New Guinea economy. And they've largely been unsuccessful in that, in the sense that They've had to put an awful lot of effort into trying to sort out the foolishness, what they see as the foolishness, and have really got nowhere very fast. The World Bank, for example, controls Papua New Guinea from its Sydney office, and that includes East Timor, Papua New Guinea, Solomon Islands, Vanuatu, and the Pacific Islands. They couldn't do anything in the Solomon Islands for a long period of time because the Solomon Islands defaulted on World Bank loans, and under World Bank rules that you can't do anything if people don't pay you. So they had to pull out of the Solomon Islands. East Timor was a disaster. Papua New Guinea's been a disaster. So the World Bank hasn't done very well at all in Papua New Guinea. The IMF has been really disastrous in Papua New Guinea because its neoconservative agenda has brought actual misery. It's forced a contraction in education spending and in health spending. These things go in waves. A period of rationalization, and the IMF tells the Papua New Guinea government to cut back on expenditure, so they cut back on health and they cut back on education. What happens when they cut back on health? Babies die. It's as straightforward as that. The health services run out of medicines, and women and children just can't get the facilities, access to the facilities. Now that happened during the 90s. I lost a grandchild because of that type of foolishness. So the IMF and the World Bank have not been particularly successful in Papua New Guinea. Australia looks at Papua New Guinea as part of its own national interest. And its when I say Australia's national interest, of course, what I mean is both defense interests and Australian commercial interests, which control Australian policies.
So what kind of response has there been to those kind of impacts that you just talked about, the social impacts? Because I know that there have been major mobilizations of Papua New Guineans against the austerity measures that have been put down by these institutions.
Well, I mean, it's true that there has been a certain amount of resistance, but it's largely in the towns. I think the worst sort of impact has been the deterioration in services in the rural areas, and the inability of the government to make any connection at all with a vast majority of rural people. And this is common throughout the Third World, that these countries like Papua New Guinea, Haiti, Dominican Republic, etc., and what you see there are economic disasters of states that just can't function, and people who are left, communities who are left on their own. Now, perhaps the only good thing that Papua New Guinea's got going for it is that its communities are still relatively intact. And so if the government falls over, as it virtually has done, the people are at least able to feed themselves because they control their own agriculture.